Willow Valley Communities recognizes the need for a national conversation about the Vietnam War and is proud to support the efforts to preserve the memories of those who lived through it. More information is available at willowvalleycommunities.org. The law firm of Saul Ewing, Arnstein and Lehr, who are proud to partner with WITF in preserving our history to enable future generations to explore the past, understand the present, and create the future. Saul Ewing is online at saul.com.
Funding for Smart Talk is provided by Capital Blue Cross, providing healthcare coverage accepted by doctors and specialists in all 50 states. Serving the community for over 75 years, Capital Blue Cross is behind you for whatever lies ahead. More information is available at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by Pinnacle Health, who is studying a new surgical technique that allows surgeons to make repairs to the heart without having to open the chest cavity and while the heart is beating. Info at pinnaclehealth.org.
Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. The Tet Offensive is generally considered the turning point of the Vietnam War. North Vietnamese troops and Viet Cong guerrillas staged coordinated attacks in dozens of cities and other places in South Vietnam. The surprise raids occurred in late January of 1968, on the eve of the Lunar New Year, the most sacred holiday in Vietnam. South Vietnam's capital, Saigon, was attacked and got most of the attention at the time, but fighting was most intense in the city of Hue, about 50 miles south of the north-south border. Our guest today has written about that prolonged battle in his new book, Hue 1968. Mark Boughton joins us. Mr. Boughton, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532, or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Before we get into the book, just want to kind of set up why you wrote the book. I understand that this is a book that you really didn't want to write. Why is that?
Well, I had written a book about a battle, about the Battle of Mogadishu called Black Hawk Down, and it was such a big success that I kind of felt trying to write another book about a battle was maybe not a good idea. But, you know, the idea kind of grew on me and eventually took hold.
So what did change? Why did the story of Hue needed to be told?
Well, you know, the more I thought about, writing about Vietnam in particular, it was obviously, I'm 66 years old, so, you know, I was in high school when this happened, and it was a big issue in my house and a contentious one between my father and I. And I realized that for nearly everyone in my age group, Vietnam had touched our lives in a big way, one way or another. So, you know, I had never had the opportunity to really explore what happened in Vietnam. And for me, the way that I do these things is not to write sweeping accounts of the whole war. I'm much more interested in focusing on a key moment and really digging deep into it. So the idea grew on me, and it was my opportunity to really kind of explore for myself what happened in Vietnam and how I felt about it.
So let's go to Hue in 1968 and Vietnam overall. As I mentioned in the introduction, Tet is the most sacred holiday in Vietnam, and there usually is a ceasefire at that time at Tet. Set the scene for us. What was going on behind the scenes just before Tet?
Well, the United States had intervened really heavily in Vietnam and actually begun sending our own troops into combat in 1965. And over those 3 years, they had done a pretty good job of sort of stopping the spread of the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese. It kind of stopped their progress in South Vietnam, but they were nowhere near defeating them. So the war had kind of devolved into a stalemate, and it was not, as it happened, you know, proving to be the easy war that President Johnson and General William Westmoreland had sold to the American people. So there was, you know, public opposition was growing to the war. In North Vietnam, you know, they saw an opportunity to launch strikes on all of the major cities in South Vietnam, and what they hoped would happen was that the people of South Vietnam would rise up in their support, and they could end the war in one fell swoop. And that, of course, didn't happen, but that was the setting in which this battle took place.
You mentioned General William Westmoreland, who was the commander in Vietnam at the time. In fact, just before Tet, he had said something to the effect that the end was in sight, there was light at the end of the tunnel, that this would not be a prolonged war. And really, behind the scenes, I guess even maybe even publicly, you can tell me whether he did this or not, didn't have a whole lot of respect for the North Vietnamese Army or Viet Cong, didn't think that they could do a mass attack like what they did at Tet. So, you know, describe what Westmoreland was telling the American people and President Johnson at the time.
Well, General Westmoreland was someone who was very good at kind of taking a complex situation and boiling it down to talking points and selling points, really. And, you know, he convinced President Johnson, and I think, frankly, he convinced himself that the United States, you know, had the upper hand and was on its way to crushing the communist movement in South Vietnam. And so I think he was so convinced of his theory of events that when things began happening that contradicted it, his first inclination was to deny that these things had even happened. So he came back to the United States just about a month and a half before the Tet Offensive to do a sort of a public relations blitz to try to rally the American people behind the war effort. And then his main message was, you should get behind this effort because we're winning and we're almost done and we'll begin bringing troops home within the year. Little did he know that the Tet Offensive was going to get in his way.
So before we get into the battle itself, the way the city of Tet is laid out and its history is one of the aspects of this that makes it unique. Describe the city of Hue.
Well, Hue is the ancient capital of the United Vietnam. That was where the emperor had his palace. The northern half of the city is actually an enormous fortress with walls like 30 feet high and 30 feet thick, with only 9 entrances and exits. And within that fortress, called the Citadel, there's the Imperial Palace, which is sort of a fort within a fort. That's the northern half of the city. The southern half of the city, which is separated from the Citadel by the Huang River, which the Americans call the Perfume River, is the modern part of Hue. And that's where the government buildings were and the hospital and the prison and a lot of, you know, businesses. And it was a bustling and more modern section. So about half of the city lived in the Citadel and another half lived in this more modern city south of the Huang River.
The battle opens on January 31st, 1968.
Just after midnight their time, a band of Viet Cong raiders blew up a power installation and attacked 2 police stations in Saigon. Other small bands still roam the city. The Viet Cong are reported to be in complete control of a militant Buddhist headquarters less than a mile from the center of town. At Hue, the old imperial capital, 400 miles to the north, the Viet Cong is holding on to part of the town, as well as half the city of Con Tum in the central highlands. Along the northern coastline, Nha Trang and Quy Nhon have come under fresh mortar fire. And earlier today, South Vietnamese President Thieu declared martial law.
That's NBC's Frank McGee announcing on January 31st, 1968, the beginning of the Tet Offensive. So we got to hear what we heard here in the United States. Battle opens on January 31st. Talk about the opening salvos, if you will, of the Battle of Hue.
Well, what was most remarkable about the Tet Offensive as a whole was the scope of the enemy attacks. They hit just about every city and town in South Vietnam. Most of the American press was located in Saigon, and so a lot of the initial attention to the Tet Offensive was focused on the attacks in Saigon, which were mostly abortive. There were real problems. The enemy troops had miscalculated, and they'd got their timing off, and their attacks on Saigon were really just small groups of small cadres of men who ended up, you know, fighting to the death. In Hue, however, there were about 10,000 enemy forces who basically just walked into the city and took it on that evening over a period of several hours, so that by morning of January 31st, there were only 2 small compounds in the city, one an American one in the southern half and one a South Vietnamese army post in the northern half, that weren't occupied by the enemy.
And this was a total surprise, wasn't it?
it was a complete surprise, and it is probably ranks as one of the biggest intelligence failures in the history of the United States military. And I don't know, even just, you know, speaking of Hue itself, how you can amass 10,000 troops outside of the third largest city in South Vietnam over a period of months without anyone sounding an alarm is a fairly remarkable accomplishment. And I think the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong deserve credit.
Was that partly because of this lack of respect for the opposition, the enemy?
It was partly that. I think there was a great deal of arrogance in the American command. And I also think it reflects the degree of popular support that the revolutionary movement had, particularly in the rural areas around the city. Because if, you know, someone in any of those villages had chosen to, they could have sounded an alarm, you know, well before this attack took place, and it never happened.
But at the same time, as you mentioned a little bit earlier, one of the objectives of the Tet Offensive was to bring South Vietnamese over to the side of the revolutionaries. But that didn't happen for the most part, did it?
No, it didn't. And it reflects, you know, the misunderstanding and miscalculation in Hanoi, which is, of course, the capital of North Vietnam. And just as the United States underestimated the enemy and had a flawed notion of how well the war was going, in Hanoi they had their own misconceptions, and they believed that the people of South Vietnam were much more supportive, particularly in the big cities, and they felt like all they had to do was really strike a match, and the whole southern part of Vietnam would rise up in support. And in truth, they did have widespread support in the rural areas, but in the cities, not so much.
So, as you mentioned, on January 31st, the North, had these thousands of troops, even though it was at first reported hundreds of troops there, and the fighting began. Marines started battling back, and they're reporting heavy fighting and many enemy troops, but the commanders don't believe it. Why not?
Again, I think it goes back to arrogance, to the disbelief that the enemy was capable of moving that many troops into Hue. And so they discounted some of the initial reports from the men in the field as being panicked or young soldiers who had never really faced combat before. So they were, you know, intimidated. And so instead of sending or at least halting fighting until they could supply their men or reinforce them sufficiently, they kept hurling them against this superior force that was well entrenched, and many Americans were killed because of that.
And I'm going to talk about that in just a moment, because what you're describing was actually block by block, house by house fighting, urban fighting that the Marines really hadn't been trained for and hadn't experienced a whole lot in Vietnam. But before we do that, there's a city called Khe Sanh. And Westmoreland had this obsession with Khe Sanh. Tell us about that.
Well, Khe Sanh wasn't a city. It was actually a little Marine outpost in the Central Highlands, very near the Laotian border. And General Westmoreland was convinced that the enemy was planning to overrun this Marine base in Khe Sanh. And he focused all of his attention and effort on trying to protect this Marine base, and it turned into, you know, a very long, a sort of a prolonged standoff, and a big attack actually never even came there. When I was in Hanoi, you know, I talked to their veterans, and many of them told me that, you know, for them, Khe Sanh had been a feint all along, that they had designed an attack on Khe Sanh to lure General Westmoreland's troops out into the hills, instead of staying near the urban centers, which is, of course, where the big attack actually came.
And even once the fighting had begun in Hue, Westmoreland still was convinced, and he had Johnson convinced, that the big attack was going to come at Khe Sanh, right?
That's right. You know, and I think part of it was his disbelief that the enemy had moved into Hue in such large numbers, and part of it was he was simply, like a lot of people who are, you know, theorists, he was wedded to his own theory of what was going to happen. And he serves as kind of a, I think, sort of a warning to people who develop theories about the world that the world is a little bit more complicated than they might think.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
Willow Valley Communities recognizes the need for a national conversation about the Vietnam War and is proud to support the efforts to preserve the memories of those who lived through it. More information is available at willowvalleycommunities.org. The law firm of Saul Ewing, Arnstein, and Lair, who are proud to partner with WITF in preserving our history to enable future generations to explore the past, understand the present, and create the future. Saul Ewing is online at saul.com.